Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. These have been a great set of playoff series in the first round. And do you know why I can really tell that?
Why?
It's kind of like Bill Nye the Science Guy season. Everyone's breaking out the microscopes, dissecting late game scenarios like it's the end of the world right now. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's the Raptors. Doesn't matter if it was James Harden and the Rockets and Woodgabe, the Pacers and the Cavaliers. We have officially reached the best time of the season where, like, every possession goes under the microscope. Everyone, it's sort of their entire reputation hangs on whether they make or miss that hero ball shot.
Yeah.
Fan bases, hearts either swell or they're broken. And I, you know, I'm actually looking right at you, frankly, right now, because the Washington Wizards are back in this thing, you know, evened up at two games apiece. But all across the NBA landscape, we've had these moments late in games where they're going down to the wire, they're close games, and players either step up or they fail miserably, and either way, people go nuts. That's when the NBA is at its best, and really, that's what we were missing last year with so many double-digit blowouts and one-sided series. This is sort of what we come to expect this time of year, and I love it.
It is awesome. It also got much better over over the last, like, five days, because all of the series are now kind of like either knotted up, or I mean, it looks like the Spurs are toast at this point. And then what's the other series that's over? Oh, the Blazers.
Yeah, that one was really going, you know, late game, like Drew Holiday. Some of the stuff he was doing in late game situations was incredible. But what I love is just how different people dissect these series. Like, some people go psychological. Like, is there something wrong with, like, James Harden? Or,
yeah,
you know, is DeMar DeRozan addicted to the log too? like people come at it from, like, every possible different scientific angle in these situations. And really, what we're just watching is a basketball game. You know, guys are taking 30% shots and sometimes they go in. But
yeah, it's messed up. The decision making. That's how you know that all of this, sports are more fun the crazier the analysis gets and the more unfair we are to actual athletes. That's how you know the stage is getting bigger and bigger.
There's also, like, the child development psychologists who are coming through and saying, you know, a team like Indiana, they just haven't been there before. You've got to learn to fail before you can learn to succeed. You know, with the way they blew that game four down the stretch against Cleveland, and you bring out all of the, you know, Dwayne Wade, he's got the experience factor. Of course he's going to be able to do it late in the games. I mean, we just get every possible way you can approach these same questions, and it makes for great discussions. It makes for a lot of fun. And I got a sense from some of these questions that came into openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com, that we're not the only people having fun with this.
Yes. So we've got a lot to get through today. Who knows how much of this we'll actually get through. But we'll start and just sort of take each series one by one and see what happens. Kevin says, can we definitively say that this postseason is already better than all of last year's postseason? I'm going with yes there, and we don't need to dwell on it. We already covered that. Let's move on to a comment we got during the Rockets-Wolves first half here, which I don't know if you've seen because you don't check your mentions. But Tori says, watching the playoff Rockets makes me realize that since it's a regular season award, Mike D'Antoni should win Coach of the Year every year. His system makes you forget that the Rockets really only have one superstar. And first of all, amazing Chris Paul shade there. And that came as part of a wave of Rockets hate that really, like, crested during like the mid second quarter when they were duking it out with the Wolves. And we actually delayed the start of the podcast because we were like, well, maybe the Rockets are just going to melt down here. And that's going to be another curveball to add to the playoff chaos that we're watching. And then Harden comes out and just is, like, out of his mind in the third quarter. I think he finished with 22 points in that third quarter. Chris Paul was great as well. And maybe the Rockets are okay. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, first of all, you're using that royal we again. You've got that mouse in your pocket again. Look, we did not delay the start of the podcast because the Rockets might crumble and fall apart. You did, because you were hoping it would happen so you could bag on James Harden and the rest of them yet again. And guess what? It didn't happen. And this is what I mean about using these scientific approaches, Andrew, come playoff time.
Mm-hmm.
We don't measure climate change by the temperature on a random day. We have to look at the big picture. Sure, James Harden might go cold for a quarter. What happens? You know, expand the sample size, and this guy's playing pretty well. He had a great game one.
Yeah.
And like you said, he turned it on in the third quarter of game four. So I think there's a little bit too much overreacting going on in some of these situations. But I do want to ask you one thing to go along with the first question about, is this year's postseason better than last year's already? I'm not suggesting that the NBA is worse off for not having Steph Curry, but does Steph's absence, has that really allowed a lot of these other people to sort of take center stage a little bit, to have everyone else seem like they're in competitive series and have a chance? Has it almost been kind of a blessing in disguise, at least for this opening week? I mean, obviously we want Steph back for the Western Conference Finals and the Finals, yeah. But I think the excitement factor around a team like Philadelphia, or even the intrigue around a team like Houston, or frankly, like the possibilities of what can New Orleans do, aren't all of those stories richer and more interesting because Steph Curry is not looming as this guy who's going to get 30 points, in 20 minutes and then just ice his knees up in the fourth quarter of playoff games? I mean, isn't that part of the reason why this has been so much fun?
Yes, 100%. Did you listen to me on the radio earlier today?
No, I didn't, but I understand you do steal a lot of my takes when you do other media appearances. So.
No, so we were talking, I was with JD Bunkus on Toronto 590 The Fan. And
hold on, you think I tune in to local Toronto
well,
sports
I don't know.
Radio?
Look, we had this exact conversation about how this, and they asked me, they were like, do you think that Steph receding from the spotlight has helped like shine a light on how fun the rest of this league is, and basically not having the Warriors loom over everything has allowed us to enjoy kind of the mess beneath them a little bit more? And all in. I agree 100%. I think that has been great, and I'm probably going to end up writing about it at some point over the next week or two, just because the rest of the league, it kind of, I mean, we don't need to make this an anti-Warriors thing, but like, it speaks to how exciting this will be when the title really is up for grabs.
Look, Andrew, you're my work husband. I support everything you do. I try to read every word that you write on SI.com. But if you want me to listen to your local sports radio hits, you're going to have to text me the streaming links, okay? I'm not going to be just going through like with my scanner radio.
You have a tortured history with Toronto, and I never know when you're listening, when you're not, right? Who knows?
Oh, I'm in your head then. That's good. Well, congratulations. You had a good take. I'm glad you had that conversation with the lucky people up there in Toronto. Did you rub any salt in their wounds after the Game 4 meltdown? I mean, I think it was a 26-8 closing push by the Wizards to even the series. Toronto, I mean, it was classic relapse,
yeah.
Right?
No,
I mean,
we had a,
what
lot.
Do
we had
do?
A fun back and forth, all right? I'm not rubbing any salt in anyone's wounds right now because I'm not going to jinx the Wizards. The Wizards are, I mean, they're okay for now, but I'm not going to tempt fate on that one.
I was going to say, you reading that email, that pep talk from Joe last week where he told you to basically buy back into the Wizards, it was exactly what you needed. I think the Wizards needed it too, Andrew. I think they needed to know that you were behind them because they came out like a different team in games 3 and 4. Oh, man. Watching those guys on the podium say, yes, it's our fault. We did it again. God, we're so sick of our old stuff. I mean, that was essentially the Raptor stars were saying on that podium. And, you got to feel for them because I'm sure the fan base feels the same way.
You're all over the place right now. You're freestyling. You're Jamal Crawford out here right now. Let's stick to the script, okay? We got to talk about, I don't know. Let's talk about the Rockets for a second because I am a little concerned despite the third quarter. Like, they have looked kind of flat thus far, and I have to be honest, it makes me like physically ill to watch the other Rockets haters on Twitter just like celebrate every bad Rockets performance. And like through the first half of this Minnesota game, I really regretted picking the Rockets in our stupid bracket contest because it limits my capacity for schadenfreude with these guys. But I mean, the first week of the playoffs has not been particularly encouraging for them. Would you agree?
They're going to be up 3-1 with a blowout win,
right?
What more do you want? I mean, they have to be perfect for you, or when are you going to be satisfied? I mean, look, I think a key point here is that Minnesota with Jimmy Butler healthy or even close to healthy is not
better than an eight seed. I hear
that. You know, and this whole everyone loves to have that argument in the Eastern Conference. Well, Washington's not really an eight seed. Well, you know what? They're inconsistent. They're not that good. They're closer
they're
to an
more
eight
like
seed.
An eight seed. Yeah.
Yeah, they're closer to an eight seed than Minnesota is to an eight seed. And I think what we saw, especially in that, you know, New Orleans and Portland series, where both those teams were kind of in a similar clump for most of the regular season, and you know, Minnesota was in that same clump, is like there's a lot of very good teams, and you play the matchup game, and you know, in Portland's case, that really burned them. But I think in Houston's case, I mean, they're significantly better than all those teams that were in that clump, and they should win. But it doesn't mean we have to hold them to a standard of perfection. Now, there was a scary moment at the end of game one with Chris Paul's pass, no doubt.
Yeah.
They didn't come out and look very good in game three, but I don't think we need to be, you know, burying the Houston Rockets.
I'm not burying them.
They look solid on balance.
Listen, I'm not burying them whatsoever, but I think that if you were coming into these playoffs ready to fly the Rockets flag and claim that this is their year and that they've actually been the best team in the league all year, I don't know. It's a little shaky. And to me, it's not even it's the way they look. Like, there's just less bounce from the roster outside of James Harden. I mean, even Chris Paul has looked a little bit pedestrian. And the main thing is they are playing slower over the last like month than they had all year. And it puts a ton of pressure on those guys to actually perform in the half court. And it's just like, I don't know how sustainable that's going to be against like really, really good teams. I mean, the Wolves, they're not an eighth seed, but they're more like a seventh seed, if anything. Like, that, I mean,
Look, if the takeaway is James Harden is not going to be able to just ISO step back three his way through four wins over Golden State, then I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not going to be enough. And I think Houston's offense, last time I checked entering game four, it was like eighth out of the 16 teams in the playoffs, you know, through three games,
yeah,
which is not even close to where it was. And so I think that's some of the aesthetic stuff that you're talking about, is that they didn't really hit on all cylinders offensively. They haven't been flying and getting as many wide open threes and playing with the same type of pace as they did during the regular season.
Well,
that's fair.
And for a while,
they're still
now,
playing
it,
very
even,
well.
Even towards the end of the regular season, it started to tail off a little bit. And I just think that the way people talk about the Rockets, and I think part of it is D'Antoni there. Like, we visualize this team that's like flying up and down the court, and that's just not really what they are at this point in their life cycle. And it's going to put a ton of pressure on Harden and Chris Paul. And I basically, the selling point for me was Chris Paul's involvement, and he hasn't looked that great so far. So I don't know. It's just something to watch. The Rockets are more vulnerable than I would have expected through the first week.
No, I hear you on that. And I think, you know, if they wind up playing Utah, you know, in that series, if they continue to play sort of at this slower pace, like, Utah is going to welcome that.
Yeah.
And Utah is not going to be scared by them at all. And so that'd be an interesting matchup. You know, I do think you're right to point out, you know, Chris Paul, like, can he play better? Yes. I also think we should say, though, their defense has been pretty solid. You know, I think they've done a nice job on Towns. I don't think they've really been sort of really badly lit up overall, and they're playing the lineups that they want to play. So I guess some of it is, do you just trust their shooting to come around and to have some more big explosions like they showed in that third quarter of game four, or like Harden showed by himself in game one? And I do trust they're going to be able to get some of that back. But,
yeah,
you know, they don't get an A-plus for the first round. I'm not saying that, but, you know, I'm not going to give them a C.
Yeah.
You know, I think they're in that B-plus category.
Okay. Soft B. So let's move on from a team that has maybe a couple cracks showing to a team where the cracks are glaring. Blair says, LeBron James is a top three player of all time, but what players has he made better? Kyrie better in Boston. Kevin Love better in Minnesota. Larry Nance, Jordan Clarkson, Rodney Hood, now being called his worst ever supporting cast. Isaiah Thomas, don't cite Isaiah Thomas. That's not a good example. But then he goes on, Iman Shumpert, Tristan Thompson, J.R. Smith, Wade and Chris Bosh. He says they won a championship, but did he make them better players? Let me just say this. This is one of my least favorite conversations involving like Hall of Fame level guys, because it's sort of the straw man that you can bring up with almost any player. Like, be outside Tim Duncan, you can criticize almost every great player and ask whether they made other guys better. And it's just like it's constantly used to put other guys down. That said, well, first of all, I'll let you. What do you think about this?
Oh, I think who screened this question? You? You screened this question? Look, LeBron makes his teammates better. There's no doubt about it. Now, I think the distinction we need to make is, do his teammates' statistics suffer when they play with them? And the answer is yes, they do. Because he has a super high usage.
Amazing player.
Yeah, and he scores like 26, 27, 28 points a game basically his entire career. That takes a lot of shots and a lot of possessions to do that. So if you're an A-list guy, your numbers are going to take a hit. But I think the Chris Bosh example is great. Would you rather be a guy who's, you know, struggling for tough twos on the block, going nowhere in the playoffs, or would you rather be spoon-fed, open face-up shots and able to concentrate more of your effort on defense and get to play for, you know, a championship team twice?
It's
I mean,
true.
I think that's a pretty
the Bosh example,
a pretty easy
like he was going to be 24-10 and a first round exit for like 10 years and then he turned into a Hall of Famer with LeBron. So Bosh is probably a bad example for this guy's question.
I think he made Wade better. You look at all the shooters. I mean, he's kept so many shooters employed, including Kyle Korver, but Mike Miller, James Jones, the list goes on and on. And I also think the secondary scores, being able to freelance off of LeBron and enjoy one-on-one coverage, Kyrie Irving, you know, Mo Williams, some of these other guys have definitely benefited from LeBron's presence as well. So I reject wholeheartedly the entire premise of this question. I think if we're trying to say, hey, is LeBron a little bit too big of a presence, you know, ego-wise in his locker room? That is a fair criticism. To say LeBron does not make his teammates better when he's, you know, one of the top two passers or three passers in NBA history is ridiculous.
Okay. I agree with everything you said. However, you're right. I do screen the questions, and I included this because, as you'll recall, I went on a mini rant to you in our little group chat on Sunday night during the fourth quarter of Cavs-Pacers, because watching LeBron right now is really tough. Like, I understand, I'm not dinging his, like, game over the last 15 years and not claiming he doesn't make players better, but I also think that he bears some responsibility for the current state of the Cleveland offense, because he's been so good and so important to that team for the last 4 years. He's basically been the focal point of everything they do well. And now he's just seems like he's kind of checked out. Like, there's a lot of one-on-one, ISO, fadeaways. And to his credit, he's now making those shots, which is insane. He's added that to his repertoire. But he's not really doing everything else. Like, for the last 4 years in Cleveland, what's made him amazing is his ability to drive and kick and, like, open up the whole offense for the Cavs. And that's the way he sort of insists on playing, and that's the way Cleveland is used to playing. And now he's just kind of standing there. Like, when he doesn't have the ball, everything just sort of stops around him. He stops, and it's like Jordan Clarkson's kind of, like, ISOing to nowhere, or J.R. Smith pulling up. And the Cavs offense is kind of surreal right now, and I think LeBron is a big part of it.
Well, a couple thoughts. First of all, we should criticize LeBron for taking Kyrie Irving for granted. I think he did that. You know, I think if he had managed that relationship better, Kyrie wouldn't have wanted out, and there could have been a way they could have made that work. And I think that problem has really come home to roost here, because one really good way to notice LeBron is taking possessions, you know, kind of slow or biding his time, or maybe getting a little stagnant, over reliant on the one-on-one, you know, trying to work out of the post, is because you don't have Kyrie Irving as one of the best one-on-one players to kind of distract you when LeBron is kind of catching his breaks during games. And he talked about that after game four, is how he's already sort of in energy conservation mode because he has to play 46 minutes a game, including the entire second half of playoff games. Because they just can't take him off the court or they fall apart completely. And, you know, the postseason on-off numbers really reflect that. Like, they don't have any lineups without LeBron that are successful, and they've struggled to shoot the ball. I think their offense would look slightly better if some of the, you know, supporting guys, specifically Kevin Love, were shooting better. They haven't really gotten completely unlocked, and I think it can look better than it has. But I chalk up a lot of what you're describing to fatigue from LeBron. I think like there was that one blow by he had right at the end of the fourth quarter where he took it all the way to the basket. I think he took it past Bogdanovich, got a layup at a really key sequence. And when I watched him make that layup, I was thinking, wow, like where was that burst like the previous 16 minutes
totally.
Of the second half? And I think the answer was he was saving that energy because he knew he was going to need it for late. And so he's almost like doing a little bit of rope-a-dope.
Yeah.
That's a dangerous game to play. I mean, that's playing with fire, but you know, there's no question to me that they're leaning on him too heavily. And that's a very, you know, you called it cracks. I mean, to me, they've got craters showing at this point.
Right.
Like they should be down 3-1 to the Pacers. If the Pacers had been competent at all in the fourth quarter, they would have won that game. They went away from everything that was working for them. And Oladipo just started jacking 35 footers for no reason at all. And LeBron should be breathing a huge sigh of relief while he also tries to catch up on his sleep for the next 2 days because he's going to have to go out there and play another 46 minutes in game five.
Yeah, it just sort of bugs me for some reason. And it's not an anti-LeBron thing, but it's just the way the narrative is being spun. It's like everyone is going to talk about how he just doesn't have the help in Cleveland this year. He doesn't. And to a degree, that's completely true, obviously. But I also think that there's something to be said for the idea that he's not putting guys like Clarkson and Rodney Hood and even Love. And look, we're still getting the Rodney Hood game. Rest assured. I want everyone to know. But he's not putting them in a position to succeed the way he has in other contexts, even during this season and certainly over the past few years. And I don't know. It could absolutely be fatigue. It could also be that LeBron is so good that he can kind of coast in spots and check out and still get his numbers, because I think that is happening too to a degree. And
I think he's also frustrated. I mean, I think he realizes that that doesn't look like a championship team to me. I mean, even the most optimistic, you know, LeBron supporting person can't look at the Cavaliers as they've played through the first four games of that series and say this is a team that can win the title.
I think,
you know,
that's
they just don't look
it.
Like it. There's so many blown defensive coverages, and I think that's really where it gets frustrating. Like if you're a superstar level player, you're playing 46 minutes a night and you're seeing guys get left wide open for corner threes because, you know, coverage broke down or someone didn't help or didn't rotate or whatever. That's when you are going to start to do this, like, oh, you know, woe is me type thing. And I think LeBron does have a little bit of that to his personality too, you know?
Traditionally, there have been moments and stretches in his career when, like, he is just kind of disengaged sometimes. And I think that might be happening very quietly and could all flip in game five. I mean, they'll be at home and they should beat this Pacers team. The one thing that's funny is, like, the Cavs' defense is now pretty good in the East, like at least their playoff numbers thus far. And I think that says less about the Cavs and more about this Pacers team, because, like, there are a lot of opportunities for Indiana to go and win this series, and they just really don't have many guys outside. Like, I like Sabonis, but, like, outside of Oladipo, there's just not much there. Like, this team deserves a ton of credit for overachieving, but I don't think that they're very good.
You know how Pacers fans get really upset that there's not a lot of national attention and support for their
And that's why I'm treading lightly. I don't want to be mean, because they've been awesome and everyone in Indiana should be pumped about, like, the state of that team.
But I think it goes both ways too, because Nate McMillan, like, if he was Ty Lue, you know, or if he was Luke Walton, or if he was Steve Kerr or Greg Popovich, he lit his team up after game four. He called them out for hero ball shots.
Yeah.
You know, he basically said they played basketball the wrong way. There was no way they're going to win if they kept playing that way. And it doesn't wind up being that big of a story, because it's like, oh, it's just the Pacers. Like, they're basically supposed to lose to LeBron, right? Like, so you benefit, Indiana. You're flying under the radar for the good and for the bad. Like, you don't have 50 reporters at your practice tomorrow saying, like, oh, Victor, like, Nate McMillan was basically calling you a ball hog.
Totally.
You know, like, that stuff doesn't happen. But I just wanted to underscore everything Nate McMillan said. I thought he hit the nail on the head. If Indiana simply ensured that they passed the ball five times on every possession, I think that they would score basically every possession. I mean, Cleveland's defense will break down. And, like, Domantas Sabonis was getting so much stuff around the basket because they're just the simple dump-off passes where Cleveland's interior defense, when they go small, wasn't able to kind of stick with it and you know, continue to contest. And why he came out at the end of game four, I don't really know. I thought that was a mistake by Nate. But if you just keep the ball moving, you are going to get open shots. Like, this is not, Bohan Bogdanovic, turning into Drazen Petrovic. You know what I mean? Like, they're getting good looks, and Cleveland's been giving up lots of points all season long, and that's why it was so frustrating in Game 4, because Indiana should be up 3-1. We should all be just melting down over the end of the LeBron era. That's what we should be doing on this podcast right now, and instead we can't because they blew the game.
Yeah, there's been a lot of Indiana should be up 3-1, but keep in mind the Bogdanovic 40-footer at the end of Game 3 was a real turning point in that one, too. So, like, I don't know. I think it's just been a mess for both sides for the last couple games. Indiana looked great in Game 1, and now it's just going to be kind of ugly to the end.
You're saying both teams deserve to be swept, basically.
Exactly. If both teams could lose this series, I feel like that would be the most justified result. Let the Wizards
in. Let's bring the Nuggets in.
Yeah, we'll bring the Nuggets for the second round. Perfect. All right, let's move on here. Speaking of the Wizards and Raptors, Miguel in Madrid says, I seem to have a brain dysfunction by which it is impossible for me to distinguish between the Raptors and the Blazers. Both are good teams with heavy backcourt combinations that fumble under pressure in the playoffs. They also have a white European center that gives mixed results and reliable benches that cannot always compensate when their stars fail to perform at the highest levels. The Blazers have already been ousted. Now I'm starting to feel real and palpable unease for Toronto's immediate future. What do you think?
Well, this is actually something that Kevin Pelton and I have pointed out in past seasons. There's a weird kind of kinship between those two organizations. There was one year where, like, if you tracked their winning percentage by day, the curves were nearly identical. It was, like, spooky and not anything within, like, reasonable math. Like, it was just completely, like, you know, it was almost as if it was choreographed or something like that.
Yeah.
But the biggest difference between these two teams, I would say, is I don't think Portland's got the bench that Toronto does. But another similarity that Miguel missed is the fan bases. I mean, they're two of the most tightly wound, excitable fan bases. And I think they really share that. And Blazers fans collectively lost their minds after Game 4. And if Toronto did lose, it would be... It might be a bigger meltdown if the Raptors lose this series than even when the Blazers lost. But, you know, past that, we the Northwest is sort of what, you know, Kevin Pelton has dubbed it.
That's pretty good.
As the Portland version. And, I think there are a lot of similarities. And I think if you put the Blazers in the Eastern Conference, by the way, they probably would have made a conference finals just like the Raptors did. And it's one more reason why we should have a 1-16 playoff format, because the number one seed in the Eastern Conference would be just another team in the West.
Yeah, that was my thought on the Blazers, is like the best argument for not blowing it up, and we'll get to this later in the podcast, is to point at the Raptors. But so much of what the Raptors have accomplished is possible because they play in the East. And I think that the Blazers are going to have a much harder time mimicking that in the West going forward. With the Raptors, though, like, I have no idea how the Wizards won Game 4. I mean,
take the bait here. Come on, let's really trash talk, Andrew. Get excited about it. It's even.
Look,
you're feeling the excitement. I saw you were there at the game. I saw you on the post game podium press conference, and you know, you looked a little stressed after Game 3, but I'm sure you were very excited after Game 4. I mean, come on, you know, walk your walk, talk your talk.
I am absolutely feeling great about Bradley Beal. I'm feeling great about the last 5 minutes of John Wall's Game 4. The first 43 minutes were a little bit more mixed for best two-way. But the Wizards didn't really play well enough to win. They started the fourth quarter tied and immediately went down 8 or 9 points. Like, and it was that kind of game for them. Like, they just were kind of screwing around the whole time. And the Raptors were somehow worse. Like, the emotional baggage for them is real, I think. And they all looked kind of dazed, and there were people getting on DeMar for the way he performed down the stretch, but, like, there wasn't anyone else on the court that I was worried about either. I mean, it was like DeMar, Lowry, like, doesn't really have the explosion that he used to as a scorer. And then it's like Anunoby, Pirtle, I mean, Siakam, like, they just don't have many options outside of DeMar. And if So I don't want to get too high on the Wizards. Let me say that. But I am definitely down on the Raptors after the last four games.
Yeah, I mean, you guys aren't good. I mean, that's just flat out. So that game four win was stunning to me. I mean,
I was shocked. It was too.
Like I said earlier, I mean, it was a relapse. You know, it was back to all of their worst behavior. And you know, I think so far through the playoffs, there's no question Chris Middleton has outplayed DeMar DeRozan in the playoffs for the second straight year. We should probably just note that. But I'm agreeing with you, actually, though. I don't put it on DeMar. I think a lot of his ISO stuff was born out of necessity.
Yeah.
He's looking around saying, like, everyone's just hot potato passing me the ball back. Like, what do I do? Well, you know, I got to get a shot up, so here we go. And I put a lot of it on Lowry. You know, I think he needs to be better, and I agree with you. He hasn't been the same guy. I mean, even the shots he's making, these ugly threes that are rattling around, like hitting the rim mm-hmm. five times, and it's just kind of weird. So I would be nervous if I was a Raptors fan. At the same time, though, home court is strong, and I think that their role players and their bench does play better at home. It seemed like a lot of those guys disappeared in Washington.
Yeah. Can I ask you for your objective opinion on the Beal foul? Because I was on the radio in Toronto earlier today. I mentioned that it was an obviously terrible call, and then got a lot of pushback from the hosts up there.
What?
Which, I don't know. From where I was sitting, looking at the Jumbotron, it looked pretty like black and white, horrible. What did you think?
I mean, are you getting plugs for this radio station you keep mentioning?
No, I'm hope sorry. So.
Like, we have a sponsor, okay? It's Buffalo Wild Wings, Andrew. We don't need to be shouting out some random sports station in
Fair
Canada.
Enough.
But no, it was. I thought it was a terrible call. I thought that call was going to swing the game. I was so ready. Like, I was pre-writing a story about the foul of, like, okay, Bradley Beal and Scott Brooks are fined like $150,000 each because you know, they swore so profanely in the post-game press conferences about the officiating. Washington handled that situation great.
They did.
You know, I mean, kudos to John Wall. Like you said, you know, down the stretch, he played very well. They just kept their composure. But no, I didn't think it was a foul on Beal. I thought everyone pretty much agreed on that.
Okay.
Especially in that situation.
Yeah, because I wasn't reading Twitter, so I couldn't really, like, take the temperature of objective, non-insane people. But I will say, in the stadium, that was such a bad call that it kind of galvanized Wizards fans like never before. Like, probably that's definitely the loudest that place has been all season, and maybe the last year or two. Just booing that one ref, and then Beal was like losing his mind on the sideline, and I was shocked that he didn't get thrown out of the game. It was quite a moment.
So was he.
Yeah.
So was he. He afterwards he was like, I'm amazed they didn't throw me out. It was clear the emotion, the passion there was real, because he thought that was going to be the series, you know?
Right.
And I think that's why you see such a forceful emotion from him. I would say, though, we got some emails talking about what a great crowd it was, and you were mentioning how great the crowd was. Like, nobody threw anything on the court, right?
I was wondering whether they were going to. It was actually funny, because a play later, Markieff Morris, had a loose ball situation, and the ref signaled the wrong direction. It was, like, clearly Wizards ball, but he signaled Toronto ball. And first of all, I thought Markieff was gonna like assault the ref, and second of all, if that call had stood, I think there might have been some thrown objects on the court, and it would have gotten kind of wild.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if that happened in Portland, I've been in some atmospheres at the Moda Center where it's like you just start looking around and ducking because you don't know what's gonna
totally
come out of the 300 level.
I was ready for it. Well, all right, hopefully the Wizards can build on that. I'm not going to jinx anything, but feeling pretty good right now. Friday night was a lot of fun. Sunday night was stressful as hell, and I can't wait for game five. This feels like this is going seven. If the Wizards are going to win it, they're going to have to win it in seven. And also, before we move on, I just want to say we're thinking of Toronto after the attack on Monday. That is awful news, and good luck to everybody up there processing things and getting through it. Obviously much bigger than basketball. But
no question about it. And for once, the royal we was used correctly, Andrew, because we both
there's not a mouse in my pocket this time. All right, let's move on to one of our favorite topics. Ricardo says, if I sell all of my Giannis Inc. shares after game four and buy them back after the Bucks come back to earth in the next few games, how much could I earn? What do you think, Ben? Where is this going for Milwaukee?
Well, I watched Milwaukee, a team that, you know, we left for dead last week, come back and beat the Celtics twice. And the whole time I couldn't enjoy the victories because you came on here slurping the Celtics, every aspect of the organization, how amazing they were. You got guilted into it by the Boston emailer because, you know, supposedly we hadn't talked enough good things about them. Did you feel shame as you were watching Milwaukee win game 3 and 4? Didn't you wish you had maybe held a firmer line and not given Boston so much credit? Because,
no.
You know, where was like the golden boy, Brad Stevens? He got outcoached by Joe Prunty, you know, twice in a row. I mean, come on.
Joe Prunty. I feel bad for Joe Prunty. He is such an easy target at this point. I think I called him a Brian Hill body double on Twitter the other day. And people have just been taking shots at him for months. But look,
he deserves it. He didn't take the fine for Giannis.
Yeah,
and look,
right.
they're still, even when they're playing well, I mean, he did make one key adjustment, putting Thon in. I mean, that was a shocking move that actually worked. Thon played pretty well at home.
Yep.
I really hope he does not disappear in this series. That would be sad because he needs to sort of build some positive momentum and trajectory for his career. But, you know, Giannis, the tip-in was sensational. I mean, he's been working unbelievably hard in all these games. He's not in energy conservation mode like LeBron. I mean, he doesn't have the luxury of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And for him to sort of battle and scrap in the paint, you know, final seconds of that game to pull that out was pretty sensational. But I do hear what the emailer is saying. Like, Milwaukee really has no business beating anybody in the postseason, you know?
So, I have a couple thoughts here. First of all, I don't regret my Celtics optimism because I'm talking about the future Celtics when I'm being optimistic and being complimentary of what they've got, okay? I have been very clear for the last 6 weeks that I don't care about this current version of the Celtics. I'm not particularly moved one way or the other. I was talking to sitting next to a reporter on Friday night watching Celtics-Bucks Game 3, and I was like, I still think Milwaukee could take this series because looking at that Boston team, they just don't really have anything. I mean, it's Horford and then like Jaylen Brown has had a lot of nice moments. And again, that's like once Jaylen Brown becomes your fourth or fifth best player, it gets kind of scary. But if he's your second best guy, still not in great shape. So the Celtics side of this, like I think that they are super beatable. The Milwaukee side though, man, I like Eric Bledsoe is really brutal to watch for them. And he like almost by himself makes their offense vulnerable and makes them like much easier to handle. I think you're right to mention Thon. We got like some of the best Jabari basketball we've seen since before the injury last year. He looked
totally
great. I don't know. I mean, if Thon and Jabari can be like the best version of themselves or close, then this series is definitely going to Milwaukee. I don't know if I trust them, though, going forward.
Yeah, Bledsoe drives me crazy. He really needs to sheath or resheath his swag because this guy, he gets fouled and he goes, you know, he's got basically no statistical contributions. He gets fouled. He's screaming. He's trying to pump up the crowd. Yeah, yeah. You know, he's trying to get people going. Then he misses the free throw right
after. Yeah, that was perfect sequence for him.
The story of his life.
You know what?
But
while you're on the subject, first of all, there are two things I need to mention. I'm thinking of like listeners who didn't listen on Friday and hear you just like casually drop sheath or unsheath his swag. Like that's a normal thing that humans say. So shout out to any of those people. But secondly, I was talking to a friend about Bledsoe on the way to the Wizards game on Sunday. And he was saying, like, if like the thing that's been helping Bledsoe for years now is that he just looks like he should be an awesome basketball player, and so everybody has given him the benefit of the doubt based on like the 15 minutes a game he was getting on the Clippers like 8 years ago, and people just want to believe. And the flip side of that is that Chris Middleton is so nondescript and just boring that people don't give him nearly enough love because he's just kind of there. And I know I'm on a podcast with the one person in America that is absolutely giving him enough love, but it's kind of an interesting dynamic to think about because like if Chris Middleton looked more like Eric Bledsoe, we would be talking about him in like a Paul George category.
Yeah, I mean, I was sitting over here wondering how many games in a row he would have to slay before you finally said something positive about him. It turned out the answer was 4 playoff games, yeah. But that's fine.
He's been great.
I'm glad that you came around.
Playoff
He's
K.
been unbelievable. Playoff K was sensational. Did you see him go at the reporter too, by the way? He went at Celtics Nation pretty hard. There was a Boston media member who apparently, during shoot-around or something like that, referred to Chris Middleton as Jabari. And he asked Chris Middleton in the post-game press conference a question about Jabari. And so Chris Middleton could not help himself, called the guy out. He's like, hey, aren't you the guy who screwed up my name earlier today? The guy tried to deny it, Andrew. He tried to weasel his way out of it. And Giannis goes, yep, that's the guy. Calls him out. Guy has to own it. I mean, that should have counted as a third loss. You know, in my mind, Milwaukee should be going back up 3-2 after that sequence. Chris Middleton, beautiful podium moment to compliment his brilliant play on the court.
Yeah. Well, before we move forward here, did you see the story about Giannis in the Mexican restaurant after the game, game four?
I know that's a rhetorical question because, of course, I saw it. Giannis Inc. PR department in damage control over this. Come on, please explain it.
I don't know. I think they're going to drive this poor Mexican restaurant out of business. Bucks fans are currently outraged. What happened is after Giannis had the game-winning tip-in, which, by the way, we haven't really talked about. I think you mentioned it. I mean, that was a quietly ridiculous play. Like, the athleticism that it takes to make that happen is kind of insane, and just something that we all kind of take for granted with Giannis at this point. And as is true of the Horford dunk with like 2 minutes left, he was just absurd. Anyways,
yeah, the most impressive part about that tip-in, though, is that he was wrestling with Jason Tatum, and Jason Tatum's only 20, Andrew. I don't know if you know that.
I've heard that. It's really impressive. Imagine where he's going to be in a couple years. So after that game, Giannis goes to a Mexican restaurant near the stadium, and it's packed with Bucks fans who are celebrating, and Giannis is trying to get a table, and thanks to an intrepid Twitter user who's like tracking all this, he sees Giannis just waiting there, and then finally, after 10 minutes of not being seated, he has to turn around and leave, and that has caused like uproar throughout Milwaukee now for the last 24 hours, which I just, the whole thing is amazing to me.
Well, apparently they issued a statement saying they're giving out free tacos if Milwaukee wins, or, you know, they are saving a table for Giannis after game six. They're trying to do the damage control, but I don't think this is only on the cantina, Andrew. I think this is on Milwaukee society as a whole. How can Giannis just walk into a Mexican restaurant and not get mobbed after a game-winning tip-in in a game over the Celtics? Like, shouldn't... First of
You're
all,
right.
He should have to wait in line. But shouldn't there be a line of people just wanting to touch him and take selfies and do whatever else you would do with, you know, a player
what?
Who's a top 10 NBA guy? In so many markets, you wouldn't even be able to do that. So what's wrong with the Milwaukee market? I've been reading all these stories, and I think a lot of them are true in terms of the Bucks exploding popularity locally. But Giannis should not be able to go to a cantina. Like, forget the cantina part of it. Like, he should be so much more famous.
He should be
mobbed.
He's one
of the best athletes.
You're right. You know, first of all, we're going to get there in a couple years with Giannis Inc. Maybe it'll happen in LA and not Milwaukee. But hearing you talk, I now feel less sympathy for the cantina, because if like Aaron Rodgers had walked in there, for instance, or Ryan Braun, I don't think Ryan Braun is still on the Brewers, but if he was still there, or like even someone like Frank Kaminsky walking into that place, would have immediately been seated. It is fucked up on the Mexican restaurant's part. So I hope that Giannis drives them out of business. Great takes from you.
Okay, slow down a little bit. We don't want them to go out of business. That's, you know, hardworking American jobs, okay?
Okay?
So let's hope they stay in business, but let's hope that they have, like, a little Giannis shrine. He gets his own table that's always open for him 24/7, 365, whenever he wants to go there. But I think, you know, sort of bigger picture, it says something about Giannis too, Andrew. I mean, when do you think the last time LeBron walked into a restaurant completely unannounced and just wanted to wait for a table?
Yes.
You think LeBron's going to Olive Garden, you know, like on road trips? No. I mean, he's got people to handle that. And it's just amazing that Giannis could be as famous and as successful as he is. And he's just walking in with his girlfriend casually to, like, let's get some tacos after the game. That was so cool. I tipped the game winner in. Yeah, let's go get some tacos.
It's also why he's still great, by the way. It's why Giannis is the best.
That's what I'm saying. It's amazing. I mean, because think about how many guys on that level, really, top 10 guys, do you think go about their daily routine tasks by themselves? They don't have people to handle it. You know, they don't have coordinators. They don't have assistants or whatever else. I mean, I'm sure Giannis has his own staff too, but they weren't there that day. And it was just really funny to see that image. Like, why is Giannis there? You know, forget the cantina, forget the fans. Like, what is Giannis doing?
It was great. I think if you're seriously asking, I could also imagine Anthony Davis going about his business all by his lonesome. And like Giannis, he's in a market where people care 10 times more about football than they do about basketball, and people would probably leave him alone. So I think it's more a function of context with those guys.
That's a great point. Like, he could walk around with his unibrow out, no one stops him, but if you put on a Saints helmet, all of a sudden he'd be like signing autographs all afternoon.
Exactly. But let's move on. And before we do, talk about one place that is definitely not going out of business. Ben, talk to me about B-dubs.
Well, I'll tell you a place that would save a spot for Giannis and for all of Giannis Inc.'s loyal members. It's Buffalo Wild Wings. And I was thinking, Andrew, you know what's really whack?
What?
Double bacon. If you're still rolling with double bacon, you're so behind the times, because there's a new boss in town at Buffalo Wild Wings. And that boss deals in bacon, triple bacon, because it's the Bacon Boss Burger. It features bacon three different ways, not two, three different ways, plus thrown in for no extra charge, a blanket of white cheese sauce. That Boss Burger is joined by other new favorites at Buffalo Wild Wings, like the Smothered Cheese Steak Quesadilla, Sweet Chili Shrimp, and Alaska Cod Classic, all vegan friendly, in that if you have friends that are vegan, they're probably going to have to eat something.
No, that's not true, actually. I did some research before the podcast. There are a number of vegan friendly options, beginning with the black bean burger at Buffalo Wild Wings. And then there's a bowl of carrots and celery. And there are at least four or five other options that you could hit up there if you're a vegan.
Andrew, how did you prepare more for the Buffalo Wild Wings ad read than you prepared for the rest of the podcast combined?
Yeah, you know what? It was after our last podcast, actually. I got curious and Googled, because I figured they had to. And sure enough, the black bean burger...
They've got everybody covered, Andrew. Come on, it's Buffalo Wild Wings. It's Big Dubs. That's where you're going after the
game.
And
you know what, Ben? They all pair perfectly with a Sam 76, a fruity ale with the crisp finish of a lager. So hurry in today and try them all before they're gone at Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports, available for a limited time while supplies last. Please drink responsibly and enjoy the NBA playoffs. Let's get back to the playoffs, though, Ben. And this is a tricky one, because this is one series that is currently in progress as we record this. But Clint says, do you guys still think OKC is going to pull this series out because they have the superstars? Jazz are winning the X's and O's and mixing it in with great individual performances like Rubio's playoff triple-double. Derek Favors has been a quiet pillar of success. God, that's a perfect Derek Favors sentence. Rudy Gobert is Defensive Player of the Year. Donovan Mitchell not playing like a rookie. I don't know. What do you think, Ben?
Well, I picked Jazz in six for this series. And the way Game 3 played out and the way that Game 3's aftermath played out is exactly Utah's formula. Like, frustrate Westbrook, have their offense look kind of inconsistent and shaky, and then have Westbrook decide to turn it into this personal battle, like grudge match between him and Ricky Rubio. It's exactly like the Westbrook rules, right, of how you take down the Thunder. So I think from the Jazz standpoint, they're right where they want to be, and their home court might be the best in the league during this postseason. I mean, Philly's up there too, but that crowd in Game 3 from the television, at least from the looks on television, was insane, was it not?
Yeah, no, it was wild. And I don't know. I mean, the way I think about it, it's hard to say what's actually happening here, because OKC has been having these games all season long, and it's just like when their offense breaks down, it looks really ugly and just kind of hopeless. And I don't know how much of that is just sort of a feature of the OKC team as presently constituted, or is a function of the Jazz defense. I think it's probably a little bit of both. I think the big difference has been Joe Ingles has gotten going the last couple games. And like I said, after game one, like their whole season changed when he became more of a factor, both in the pick and roll and hitting from three. Like he's a sneaky good distributor, maybe not even that sneaky at this point. And then like when he's going, the offense works much better. I don't think they're going to get another triple double from Rubio, but they'll probably get more from Donovan Mitchell going forward. Like, I think this is more about Utah winning it than OKC losing it, I guess.
Yeah, I hear you. And I also think a point that a number of people have made is just how Gobert can limit Westbrook's best offensive feature, which is attacking the basket and setting up those second chance points, you know, if he misses the layup, or just being able to get to the free throw line and just get a lot of high percentage stuff around the basket. You know, Gobert really limits that. So he's, you know, forcing Westbrook to default to his second or third options. And sometimes Westbrook's decision making on those kinds of situations, you know, his tendency to pull up and take, you know, weird contested shots, or just his over-reliance on his ability to hit stuff that he's not good at hitting, definitely drags Oklahoma City's ceiling down from an offensive perspective. So I think they've kind of controlled the style and pace. Like you said, Ingles has played well. Mitchell has played very well. And then defensively, they've been solid, and they've been able to stay big. I mean, I think from a matchup standpoint, if you can keep Favors and Gobert on the court together, you should have a really, really good defense, because, you know, you're going to be cleaning the defensive glass. You're going to be able to, you know, really limit other teams to one opportunity. And you've got a lot of size there and a lot of shot blocking and shot altering capabilities. There's not that many teams in the league you'd be able, at least Western Conference playoff teams, where you'd be able to get away with playing both of those guys. But Oklahoma City just doesn't have the personnel to play them off the court. And I think that's a big reason behind Utah's success.
Yeah, that's a great point. If Melo were 4 years younger, I don't think Favors is able to stay out there. But the current version of Melo is just like doughy enough for Favors to abuse. And then on the other end, he just can't really take advantage of it the way I think like the idea of Olympic Melo would, or the way we dreamed he would. But I don't know. Let's reserve judgment on this one. There's going to be like major schadenfreude if OKC actually blows this series, which I think is a distinct possibility at this point. And as much as I said great things about the Jazz, I think if you're OKC looking at this from like 10,000 feet, to lose to this Jazz team after everything they pulled off back in August and September would be like a major blow, and probably signals the end of Paul George down there, right?
Yeah, I mean, it would be, you know, winner Paul George leaves. I think that's the equation, no question about it. But I think one thing I would say, I want to see Utah-Houston. It's a more interesting matchup, and I think, you know, Utah presents some Spurs-like challenges for Houston. I would like to see that matchup more than Houston-OKC, I think, because I do think the Thunder's issues haven't really been solved, and they would struggle against the Rockets. And then just to go back real quick to what we were talking about earlier, I would rather see Milwaukee advance to play Philly than Boston, because, you know, assuming that Philly advances too, obviously, because of what we've been saying about, you know, Boston's like limited ceiling and health issues. Yes, the future Celtics are more interesting, but part of the reason, you know, we were kind of hoping that Milwaukee would pull its stuff together and not be completely ridiculous like they were in the first two games is because having Giannis versus Simmons and Embiid as a second round playoff matchup is a lot more fun than trying to talk yourself into Terry Rozier and Al Horford and the, you know, the other zombie Celtics.
So I agree with you in a strict basketball context. I also think that because of Boston's positioning for the future, the potential for like a 5 year long Sixers Celtics war on the internet would be pretty great. And if we want to kick that off this year, I'm all for it. And I think it's going to be a knockdown drag out battle. And that's actually a good segue. So Rodrigo says, forget the Warriors, Rockets, or Cavs. My body is ready for a Sixers-Pelicans NBA Finals. AD versus Embiid, Simmons versus Rondo, so 6'10 Rondo versus playoff Rondo, Holiday trying to guard Ben. Wouldn't it be so much fun to have these two teams match up in the finals? So, Ben, we've talked a lot about the Sixers over the last couple podcasts. I'm going to give you 90 seconds to talk about Miami and Philly and what we saw this weekend, and then we'll shift to the Pelican side of this.
Yeah, I did a story on the potential Sixers-Celtics rivalry back in the fall, and I think we would just it would be so annoying to have it happen this season because Boston would have one arm tied behind its back, and it would just be an excuse. Right. You know, it's like Philly wouldn't get any credit for doing it. The Sixers, again in Game 4, I mean, they gutted out a tough one against Miami, and they're going home in complete control. I mean, you got to love what Philadelphia did in Game 4 because, again, you just keep raising the bar for them because – so one, they were able to win in the playoffs despite being a young team. Two, they were able to win in the playoffs without Embiid. Three, they were able to win in the playoffs once Embiid came back. And then four, they were able to overcome their huge Achilles heel, which has been turnovers all season long. They had, you know, almost a franchise record for playoff turnovers, and they were still able to win a hard-fought road game. Yep. In Game 4 and take complete control of that series. So from that standpoint, you just keep raising the bar, you keep speeding up their timeline, and now I'm pretty much ready to say that no one in the East has played better than Philly.
There's,
and I'm not saying they're going to make the finals.
There's no question about that, yeah.
But they've been the East best team in the playoffs.
Yeah, and I am super high on what the Sixers are. They can beat you with two completely different styles when Embiid is on the court and or off the court. And I just they're so good. I am a little reluctant to get too high because I think one of the things that we've been understating is just how limited Miami is in some of these fourth quarters. Like, they just don't have the scores that you need to like really take over in the playoffs or really thrive, I guess. And there's a chance that Philly looks a little bit better than they actually are. But then you look at the rest of the East and there's just like, I don't see any team that's going to be able to test them that much, at least right now. But the conference finals aren't for a month. So the version of the Cavs that we get there or the version of the Wizards that we get there, who knows? Who knows what we'll have happen?
Yeah, I just say like Miami at this point, I agree with what you're saying about their limitations, but could they hang with the Pacers? Could they hang with the Wizards?
Yeah.
You know, could they hang with sort of any of the other teams that are maybe behind
that's
in their series
point.
Currently? I think the answer is yes. So again, you know, relatively, you know, Philly is kind of sitting in that catbird seat for the Eastern Conference. And you're right, they can win two different styles. And their defense has been strong too. I mean, Miami's offense isn't great, but when you're playing consistently locked in team defense and you've got Embiid back there altering a lot of shots and just keeping stuff away from the basket, it helps a ton, especially if there's not an elite, you know, playmaker on the other end. And so from that standpoint, it's just one more thing to kind of get excited about. I mean, they ground that win out in Game 4, and they shot themselves in the foot so many times in that mm-hmm. game. To still be able to win it was impressive.
Yeah. All right. So what do you think about the Pelicans? Or should we just save Pelicans for Friday and talk Blazers here at the end?
Yeah, well, we did say we were going to do a funeral for the Blazers, and they need it.
They do need it.
Would you say?
All right. So, all right. Three Blazers questions to answer here. The first is from Aaron, who says, okay, I admit, I wasn't totally random when I filled out my bracket. I had a soft spot for our hometown. Big mistake. Hopefully the state of Washington can get a franchise soon so I can jump off that ship, the Blazers ship, as soon as possible. Also, no one has used your definition of swag in over a decade. Swag are the crappy branded shirts and plush toys you get at conference booths. I think even Webster's Dictionary has changed their definition by now. Do you have a response here, Ben?
I do. This is from Aaron, my brother. You failed to mention that
part. I was going
to
let you do it.
I think he speaks for Blazer Nation in sort of the collective disappointment where, look, I understand that there were some people like you who were predicting a Blazers meltdown, but not too many people within the confines of Oregon were, and they took it very, very hard, blindsided. I mean, I think there was some admission that Portland probably wasn't as good as their, you know, 13-game winning mm-hmm. streak, but to get swept out of a team when you're swept out by a team that's the sixth seed, in such kind of humiliating fashion, where like they were trying so hard in game four to put up a fight. Didn't you think like, oh, we're gonna like push and shove a little bit here, like we're gonna go out of our way to try not to get completely punked? And you know, it didn't really work.
Yeah.
Throw on top of that the media meltdowns. I mean, I'm sure you saw that, you know, reporters calling CJ McCollum dirty, CJ McCollum's comparing himself to a lion, and
dude,
the opinions of sheep.
Hold on.
I mean, it was ugly.
That was such a bad look for both the reporter and also CJ McCollum. First of all, CJ McCollum, coming off of that series, he should feel good that someone wants to call him dirty. That would not have been my adjective. CJ is many things, but a tough grinder is not one of them. And I would take every compliment I can get as far as that's concerned. I'll tell you
one thing. As the king of the jungle, lions aren't getting swept either.
Yeah.
I've never seen a lion swept.
And
what
look,
animal could sweep
lions
a lion?
Lions are not upset about being called dirty. A lion knows what he's about. You know, that's part of the life. But look, that was a bad look, and really just speaks to the like underlying tensions in Portland right now, because, you know, I am not really familiar with that market, but it certainly seems like the fact that that even became a controversy with CJ is kind of crazy to me. Like, it's like a small college town atmosphere out there. I'm glad that Aaron called you out for your swag definition also.
Look, I'll get to him in a second, but let's talk about Portland. So they had to have like more than 10 options on the, you know, mandatory polls afterwards, like who do you blame for this disappointing loss? Like, there was so many people that everyone wanted to blame, you know, whether it's Dame, CJ, the role players who didn't show up, Nurkic, who got played off the court, Terry Stotts, who got out coached by Alvin Gentry,
right,
Neil Olshey for you know, putting together this roster of just filled with atrocious contracts. There's a certain percentage of the population that wants to blame Myers Leonard for everything, and it certainly didn't help that Myers Leonard decided to launch his own brand, the Myers Leonard brand, at his exit interview wearing
what?
A hat. Yeah, he had a hat that had his initials ML. So you can go on Instagram if you want, Andrew. I'm sure you can buy your own Myers Leonard brand hat. It'll probably be flying off the internet shelves. But like I said, there was more than enough blame to go around in every direction. But you know, in terms of Aaron, you know, my younger brother is going to try to correct me on slang. You know, Andrew, this guy, he's trying to pose for our podcast listeners. He's trying to come off real cool, Aaron. You know, you and I both know that you're not as cool as you try to sound in your email. So don't take these little pot shots at me, because I'll be home for Thanksgiving or I'll be home for Christmas, and I'm going to remind you that you're still the same little buddy who I'd put in headlocks when you were, you know, 4 years old. So don't try to do that
okay.
again. That's all I'm
yeah.
saying.
Yeah, well, I appreciate him so that I'm not the only one who has to keep you in check. Anyways, two other Blazers questions, and I have a third Blazers question. Peter says, I love Damian Lillard. That being said, WTF is up with playoff D. and then Aaron says, is it possible that the real problem is the man behind the curtain, Paul Allen? Olshey has made a lot of questionable, short-sighted roster decisions, but they all seem to fall under a framework or vision that I assume is coming from Paul Allen. Does that seem plausible? And then the third question is, like, honest to God, give me your real answer, not some like weird take. Would you just blow this team up? Because I don't see them recovering from this.
Yeah, it was a messy loss. I mean, first of all, playoff D shriveled. You know,
yes.
There's no question. I mean, he just was not ready for the moment. They apparently bamboozled him with a double team or a wall, as if he had never seen that before. I mean, he couldn't hit shots anywhere. I don't know why he was kind of blaming New Orleans' amazing scheme. I mean, he did
not.
He didn't get a ton of help from his supporting cast, but he also did not show up. And career-wise, his field goal percentage is at 40% for the postseason. He's basically Kyle Lowry. I mean, that's what you're getting in the playoffs. He's had some unbelievably, you know, exciting, amazing moments where he's delivered in the clutch. But on balance, he has not been the type of guy who really raises his game across the board in the postseason.
I appreciate you for saying that point on the Pelicans' defense, because, like, people have been talking about the Pelicans like Darren Erman is Buddy Ryan with the Chicago Bears in 19. Or I guess Buddy Ryan was with the Eagles, but they're talking about that Pelicans defense like they are like the Bad Boys Pistons. So we'll keep it NBA. And they're a good defense. They've overachieved on that end, and they were a bad matchup for Portland. But it doesn't explain, like, the extreme drop-off that happened with Lillard in this series. I think, like, struggling is one thing, but he was just, like, a shadow of himself. Or, wait, what's the saying there?
Yeah, I think
he was a shell of himself.
I would just say a shell of himself. Okay, sure. He's a shell of a shadow of himself. He wasn't a lion. We can agree on that. But look, he's a really streaky shooter, and he really depends on his ability to hit the three-pointers off the dribble, right? Like, that's a huge part of his game. It opens up everything else. If he's not able to hit those shots, you know, he doesn't do very well. Let's give Anthony Davis a lot of credit for protecting the basket, you know, and contesting shots around the rim, making life difficult for everybody. You know, he stepped up on that end as well. But they were just shell-shocked. You know, in terms of the Paul Allen factor, I don't see it that way, because Paul Allen doesn't really know basketball. He thinks he does, but he's able to be sort of talked into things along the way. And he's in the past, he's gotten very frustrated when he's been talked into something and it cost him money or it backfired and they underachieved. But I really think he's mellowed out here in the last few years. And I think a big part of the reason why is because the way the NBA's economics have changed. Like, for so many years, he was just bleeding money being in a small market, not having the huge local TV deal. But when they redid the collective bargaining agreement, after the lockout, they pretty much more or less guaranteed profitability for all the teams when they signed that new media rights deal. So he is not losing nearly as much money as he did at previous times during his ownership career. I think that's caused him to settle a little bit, you know, like he's not as quick trigger in terms of, firing GMs who have screwed up or, you know, changing coaches after a disappointing loss. Like, Paul Allen 5 years ago would have cleaned house after getting embarrassed and run off the court. And the message coming out of the Blazers exit interviews was, you know, calm and patience and all this stuff. And Neil O'Shea has always been a salesman. And I think he just sold Paul Allen on his vision. His vision, unfortunately, included a spending spree in 2016 that completely backfired, hamstrung the organization. And they don't have a lot of places to go, Andrew, because trading Evan Turner is going to be very, very difficult. Trading Myers Leonard and his brand is going to be very, very difficult. And, you know, then you have to decide, do we break up the Damian Lillard and CJ combination? And those guys might not be the world's greatest backcourt, but Neil O'Shea drafted both of them, and he has an absolute proclivity for, like, keeping his own guys. Like, that's just who he's always been. Yeah. And so that would require him to trade one of his own guys. He's never really wanted to do that. So I think, unfortunately, they're just ready to settle. I think that they're okay with this. And Paul Allen has not shown anything in the last 2 or 3 years to say otherwise. He hasn't made a big move. He spent the money when Neil told him to spend it. And now Neil is selling him a new story about trying to pivot and, you know, maybe, you know, rework things. And, you know, every once in a while, Neil throws him a bone and, you know, gets him a Zach Collins to get excited about, you know, some kind of guy with a local angle that Paul Allen can, you know, be distracted by. But, you know, beyond that, I just don't think it's a team that's serious about trying to win it all. You know, I don't think that they're on that.
I think you're right.
I don't think they're seriously in that mentality where it's win or, you know, championship or bust. I think that they're fine with selling out every home game, you know, being in the mix, you know, winning close to 50 games, calling it a successful season, and then not really caring if they go home early. And the fan base doesn't think that way. That's why the fan base has been so irate these last couple of weeks. But I think internally that's their thought process.
Yeah. And I think if that's their thought process, you know, keeping Dame and CJ is not the worst plan in the world, because those two, I mean, it's like Damian Lillard slander season on the internet, and there have been a number of, like, hilarious memes and or videos, like, thrown out by some of these, like, content factories. I mean, it was really great over the weekend. I feel bad for him. But in general, in a vacuum, they are really good, and they are going to keep you at that, like, 45 to 50 win level. The reason I would lean toward making more dramatic changes, I mean, first of all, I would fire Olshay tomorrow based on his inability to build over. I mean, like, the summer of 2016 is one thing, but, like, even the Nurkic trade, which ended up working out well and was actually a decent deal for the Blazers, but it was also sort of like a complete last ditch thing. Like, they had no other options but to just sort of roll the dice on this big man who hadn't tried in 2 years, and it worked out. But, like, the process for Olshay has just not been super encouraging, and I wouldn't trust him to build over the next couple of years either. So that's the one move that I would probably make regardless. And then I think there's an element of that 45 to 50 win zone that is important. I think you need to be able to have hopes of being something more. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think these cores have expiration dates too, right? Like, if you don't make significant progress, like, it's going to get boring for the fans to watch the same style, the same two guys going out there and shooting 20 times a night, right, every single night. And then there's going to be stretches where it looks awesome and it's really fun. And there's going to be some disappointing and kind of depressing stretches like there were earlier this season. And even, you know, for fairly long stretches of the previous seasons too. These guys are very good. They're not great. You know, they're star players. And I think that's a fundamental issue too, is like Portland's ceiling was determined by Damian Lillard really playing like an all NBA first team level guy. But if the evidence is he comes back to earth in the postseason, it's like I said, the Kyle Lowry factor is like, okay, great. Like, are you going to be a championship title winning team if your main guy is like that? No, because other teams out there have better main players. And you know, Olshay loves to say, oh, 27 teams would, you know, kill to have our backcourt. That's not true. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think anyone's really signing up for the Dame and CJ level experience. Like, it works for them, yeah, but there's a lot of teams out there that would be just fine playing against them in the playoffs and having more balanced rosters and to spend their money in more frugal, you know, ways rather than tying up such a big part of their cap into two players who, you know, aren't major plus defenders and who complement each other but aren't like a perfect fit.
The Pelicans would not have wanted the Blazers backcourt in this series. So we can start there and work on the list of teams who don't want Dame and CJ. I think that's their biggest issue going forward, though, is that they're not going to be able to recoup that value on the trade market. So, like, you're basically, because I mean, I don't think CJ is as valuable a trade piece as some of the like proposed trades make him seem. And I'm not even totally sure Lillard would be, because I think if you're trading him, he's going to want to go to a contender. And I don't know who's out there. I think if you're blowing it up, though, you have to just sort of trade them both and go scorched earth, because I don't think that you're going to be able to like sort of realign on the fly and stay at this level.
There's no way they're trading Dame unless they fire Olshay. Yeah. I mean, that's just off the table. I mean, he's so loyal to him that that's just not going to happen. I think one other factor for Paul Allen that maybe is kind of pressing him to settle is that all these stars are changing teams and picking their destinations. And when you're Portland and you're, you know, I'm from Oregon. I love Oregon. You know, I'm a proud son of Oregon, but NBA players don't like to go play in Portland if they have their choice. You know, guys who get drafted there love it. You know, there's been a lot of lifelong guys who've stuck around and been local heroes, whether it's, you know, Terry Porter, Kevin Duckworth. I mean, the list goes on.
Kevin
but,
Duckworth, all right.
Portland's not in the mix for Paul George, LeBron James, you know, like the big level players. And so if you're Paul Allen and you're out there thinking like, how am I supposed to compete for a title if I can never even get into the conversation to recruit the best players? Doesn't that at some point kind of tell you just to lower your expectations and to say, okay, yeah, let's just go have a good time and try to be good, not great. I'm not going to fire my GM. Why am I going to pay two GMs at this point? The new guy is not going to be able to lure LeBron either. He's not going to be able to get Paul George either. So what's the point?
Well, lower your expectations is a really depressing note to end the podcast on, but it's probably appropriate since we're talking about the Blazers. So with that, Ben, the Thunder are currently up 10. Do you think they can close this out?
We'll see. You know, you're asking me to predict the future. That's not my job. I would say this. You know, you're saying our motto here is lower expectations, Andrew. I want to flip that around. Let's raise expectations, because you know what we did in the recent past? We passed 1,000 reviews on Apple Podcasts. Did you know that?
Big milestone. We hit it on, I guess, Friday. Someone pointed it out.
We hit four figures. We're going for five figures next, so we got to get to 10,000. So we need everybody's help out there. Please search Open Floor on Apple Podcasts. Scroll down, hit rate and review, tap 5 stars. We really, really appreciated it. Any questions, comments, concerns, expectations that you want raised, lowered, or completely dashed, let us know. Openfloormail@gmail.com. Openfloormail podcast@gmail.com. Please, everyone, write in, except for my immediate family members trying to make fun of me. Andrew, until later this week, I'll talk to you.
All right, man, take it easy.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.